has normally been basically an APOC housekeeping matter, and to see it elevated to this level is certainly surprising.
A Juneau lobbyist faces criminal charges for failing to disclose his business activities. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, the 14th of August. Good evening, I'm Duncan Moon. Also tonight, a new study is looking at how polar bears are faring as the sea ice retreats.
Polar bears depend almost completely upon sea ice for access to the seals that they prey on.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Wells Fargo, helping customers get to the next stage through banking, loans, and retirement planning. Wells Fargo, the next stage.
Harvesting wild game is extremely important to many Alaskans, not only as a food source, but as a long-standing traditional practice. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game is committed to maintaining healthy caribou and moose populations. To learn more about the principles and guidelines behind predator management, visit wildlife.alaska.gov or contact your local fish and game office. This message is sponsored by the State of Alaska, Department of Fish and Game.
Lawyers for Senator Ted Stevens filed a handful of motions today to dismiss the charges against him. Stevens faces 7 counts of lying on his financial disclosure forms to cover up $250,000 worth of gifts from the oil field services company Vico. He's scheduled to go to trial in Washington, D.C. next month. As APRN's Libby Casey reports, the accelerated schedule Stevens' lawyers requested means the motions are coming all at once.
According to Ted Stevens' lawyers, there are loads of reasons why the federal case against him should be dismissed. In a motion filed Thursday, they say the indictment is vague, unconstitutionally vague, because it doesn't state exactly what items should have been listed on Stevens' financial disclosure forms. Senators must list all the gifts they receive worth about $300. The Justice Department says Stevens accepted $250,000 in under-the-table gifts, but his lawyers claim that the government doesn't say exactly what they are or what they're worth. The defense lawyers filed another motion, arguing that some of the charges are outside of a 5-year statute of limitations. It comes down to whether the alleged crime was a continuing scheme or multiple separate events. The government prosecutors say Stevens lied on his forms starting in 2001. Stevens' lawyers say the case should also be thrown out because it violates what's called the speech or debate clause. It says that how a legislator acted, voted, or decided shouldn't be held to judicial scrutiny. The lawyers also say the senator's staff should be protected by the speech or debate clause, so shouldn't give evidence. This is a hot topic right now in the legal world as the courts figure out just how much lawmakers should be protected. The courts recently threw out the evidence of an FBI raid of the Congressional Office of Louisiana's William Jefferson, saying it was unconstitutional. The question now is how much of a legislator's actions are protected. The defense lawyers also want a paragraph from the indictment removed. The graph alleges that during the same time Stevens was concealing gifts from Vico and its CEO, he used his official position on behalf of the oil field services company. Stevens has not been charged with bribery, so his lawyers say don't suggest he was being bribed. They call the paragraph prejudicial. And if none of that makes the judge see their point of view, Stevens' lawyers have one more argument. They say the case should be thrown out because it's up to the Senate to investigate and punish its own members. Since the alleged lies were on the Senate financial disclosure forms, Stevens' lawyers say it's the responsibility of Congress to investigate and enforce its own rules. The government prosecutors will have a chance to respond to the motions. There's much for Judge Emmett Sullivan to review, and next week he'll hold a hearing to decide whether the trial should be held in Washington, D.C. as planned, or move to Alaska, as Stevens wants. In Washington, D.C., I'm Libby Casey.
One of Alaska's most influential lobbyists, Ashley Reed, faces criminal charges on 7 counts of failure to report his business activities to the Alaska Public Offices Commission during this year's legislative session. Reed currently represents such major economic entities as Cook Inlet Regional Native Corporation, NSTAR, the North Slope Borough, and Wells Fargo. He received nearly $500,000 from clients last year. Reed says that he didn't expect the criminal charges, especially since he's filed late documents in the past.
You know, any time I've always been assessed the civil penalty, and I was very surprised by this and feel that these This has normally been basically an APOC housekeeping matter, and to see it elevated to this level is certainly surprising.
Pat Gullifson is the Assistant Attorney General working the case. In court documents, he says the reporting requirement is based on the idea that the public is entitled to know who is attempting to influence legislative activity. He agrees that Reed had filed late before and always paid civil fines, but he says there's no indication of improvement in meeting the deadlines.
In Mr. Reed's case, there is a history of civil penalties being imposed for late reports, which have not succeeded in getting timely reports. So APOC referred the matter to the Department of Law for possible criminal charges.
Reed is scheduled for arraignment on August 28th in Juneau. The Palin administration gave former Public Safety Commissioner Chuck Kopp a $10,000 severance package for his 2 weeks on the job. Governor Palin appointed the former Kenai police chief after she fired Walt Monaghan. The governor acknowledged the payment to Kopp yesterday in a news conference. Kopp resigned last month after a reprimand came to light for a 2005 sexual harassment claim against him. Attorney General Talis Kohlberg says Kopp received the severance package on top of his commissioner's salary. He said the severance package was figured quickly, but $10,000 was considered to be a reasonable amount.
He left a comfortable 19-year career in the Kenai Peninsula and took a job that lasted less than 2 weeks and fundamentally displaced his long-term plans in many different ways that he could not have anticipated, and that was seen as a reasonable way to bring what obviously was a difficult short career with us to conclusion.
In an interview with the Anchorage Daily News, former Commissioner Monaghan said he was not offered a severance package when he was asked to resign. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a Canadian perspective on climate change and energy.
We need to stop talking about the problem and start talking about the solutions.
That's just ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the State of Alaska Department of Fish and Game. Information about the state's predator management program is available on the web at wildlife.alaska.gov.
9 out of 10 of Alaska's boating fatalities are adult males. Most drowned following an unexpected fall or capsize into cold water. Cold water can kill the unprepared, regardless of swimming ability. Wearing a life jacket can make the difference between life and death. Make your family's boating memories good ones. Always wear a life jacket when boating Alaska's cold water. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
A study underway near Dead Horse is looking at how polar bears cope when they're forced to spend more time on land because of limited sea ice in the southern Beaufort Sea. The bears need good ice that's near enough to the shore to allow them to hunt their main prey, seals. The study is led by the University of Wyoming in collaboration with federal agencies. Eric Regeer is a polar bear expert researching the issue for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. He says the study has been underway for just a few days.
To date, we've captured three adult polar bears, and two of those were females, and each of those females had a cub of the year with her. So that's a little guy of about 150, 200 pounds.
Now, the bears that you've captured so far, how do they look? How are they doing?
Well, it's hard to tell. Historically, out of the current about 1,500 polar bears in the southern Beaufort Sea population, only 5 to 10% of them remain on land. So that's only about 75 or 150 bears. And those bears are dispersed over a huge area. So in several days of flying out in helicopters, we've only seen 4 or 5 bears. So it's a very small sample size to date. Of those bears, several of them have been in quite good body condition. That's to say they're pretty fat bears. Others are a little on the thinner side, and so we really need to wait until we see more bears to kind of assess, you know, how the majority of the bears on land are doing, or to make inference with regard to the population.
Well, if they're stuck on land at this time of year and they're cut off from their traditional food source, are they able to find replacement food on land?
Well, not very often. Polar bears depend almost completely upon sea ice for access to the seals that they prey on. And if you look on land here on the North Slope, there just isn't a real high-calorie available food source like seals. There may be a few ground squirrels and other things that brown bears will feed on. But if you think about it, brown bears on the North Slope have largely filled that ecological niche for a large predator or a large omnivore. So there's really not much available to these bears to feed on land.
How important would you say this study is in helping to gauge the overall picture of how polar bears are coping with global climate change?
I think it's a very important study. Previous studies here in the Southern Beaufort Sea have laid the groundwork for it. A study that ran from 2001 to 2006 provided strong evidence that in years with long ice-free seasons over the continental shelf, the polar bear population didn't do that well. And what that means is survival rates were low and also breeding or reproduction rates were low. So we've established this link between declining sea ice and reduced potential for population growth for polar bears. But there are a lot of things about it that we don't understand. This study provides a look into the nutritional cycle of polar bears here in the summer and then again in the autumn. So we're hoping to understand the mechanisms that the polar bears have available to them to cope with sea ice loss, and also figure out why, from a physiological standpoint, longer ice retreat seasons are having a detrimental effect on the population.
Is it just a question of lack of food that this is causing, or are there other things that that have a detrimental impact on the polar bear?
Well, there are probably several mechanisms by which a longer ice-free season and the declines in the sea ice affect polar bears. Our primary hypothesis is indeed they just have less time during the year that they can spend out on the sea ice hunting seals. And so that's a nutritional hypothesis. Also, as the sea ice breaks up earlier and more abruptly in some cases, it could be that polar bears are forced to swim larger distances. And indeed, in recent years, there have been several observations of polar bear carcasses in the ocean, especially following storm events, and we suspect that those are bears that drowned when they were forced to make long-distance swims and caught in rough seas. Finally, pregnant females, most of the pregnant females in the Southern Beaufort Sea, build their maternal dens in snowdrifts here on land. And so in years where the sea ice retreats very far into the polar basin, they travel hundreds of miles north with the sea ice and then have to get back hundreds of miles south to these coastal areas where they can feed and also to the land areas where they den. And so it increases the amount of energy that the polar bears spend in a year to get to the places that they have to be.
How long does it take? How much data do you have to gather for you to begin to make draw some conclusions on this?
Well, because of the expense of operating here in the Arctic and just the logistical difficulty of going out and capturing polar bears, we're often data limited. We never get as much data as we'd like to make really robust conclusions. Our goal here is to capture and radio collar 10 to 15 polar bears, both in 2008 and 2009. And while that won't answer all our questions, it'll give us enough information to start understanding the mechanisms by which declining sea ice is affecting polar bear populations. All the data, all the information that the study provides is going to be new because we've never sampled polar bears during this time of the year or tried to get at this suite of questions.
Eric Regeer is a polar bear researcher for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, thank you very much.
Kuskokwim villages are seeing some large and unfamiliar animals in the river. Residents are reporting at least one beluga whale headed upriver. KYUK's Shane Iverson reports.
A female can weigh as much as 1 ton and can measure up to 16 feet long. And as the Kuskokwim River narrows, they're hard to miss. Red Devil sits about 300 miles from the mouth of the Kuskokwim. That's where Ted Gordon lives. He was on the river with his wife on Wednesday night.
Out of the corner of my eye, I saw looked like a patch of white foam, and it was kind of wavy, and I saw a few bubbles, and I thought that was kind of strange because there wasn't any foam in the water.
Gordon said he shut off the motor, wondering if he was witnessing the whale he had heard about from Crooked Creek residents.
My wife, she heard the blowhole and stuff. She said, "Hey, I hear some air," and right about then we figured out that there was two of them.
Gordon said when they surfaced again, he and his wife were able to see two belugas. One was much smaller than the other.
It was a mother and a young baby, because the young one was darker and the bigger one was all white.
Gordon says the beluga headed upriver after passing by Red Devil. He wonders what the belugas will do now.
There's not too many places they can go, and it's dirty water.
Water levels are also receding in that area, but according to the National Marine Service, the whales do not appear to be in any immediate danger. Biologist Barbara Mahoney.
Belugas, unlike maybe other larger whales, seem to do very well in riverine, estuarine environments.
A few belugas have made similar trips over the last decade and a half, but this one has been spotted by several people. Mahoney says the danger does not come until late fall when temperatures drop and the whales need access to oxygen and food.
They remain in the fresh water or fresh rivers when it starts to freeze. The danger would be maybe being caught upriver when it's frozen and they will not be able to make it down.
The belugas could offer a rare food source to communities along the river, but in Red Devil, surrounded by mountains, Gordon says he doesn't expect anyone to go after them.
We'd have an idea of how to skin them and, you know, how to clean them. But what I tried before, I tried a little piece of whale before, and you have to have a taste for it.
But if and when they make their way back towards the coast and near the population hub of Bethel, that could be different. Mahoney says belugas do fall under the Marine Protection Act, but that act does allow for a legal hunt of the whales in some circumstances.
That does allow native subsistence harvest on marine mammals in Alaska for subsistence purposes and for native handicraft. So if that definition is met, then subsistence harvest is allowed.
In Bethel, I'm Shane Iverson.
A Canadian legislator has shared a vision for the future of energy in North America at a conference of Arctic parliamentarians in Fairbanks. Robert Mills, who chairs the Canadian Parliament's Environment Committee, says there needs to be a fundamental shift in our perspective on climate change and energy.
I encourage all of you to develop a vision. We need to go to the future. We need to stop talking about the problem and start talking about the solutions.
Mills said a range of energy sources from fossil to renewables could together feed North American demand if we developed a shared power network.
Why not Alaska, the Yukon, British Columbia, Alberta, Washington, Oregon, California? Why not a better integrated grid?
Mills reminded attendees that Canada is the leading energy supplier to the U.S. Mills said cleaner, smarter techniques for extracting and burning fossil fuels need to be developed. He described how CO2 is being injected in Alberta to enhance oil recovery.
We have been capturing carbon from two major petrochemical plants for 10 years and sequestering it for increased oil recovery. And in fact, oil wells that had been capped 20 years ago are today producing more oil than they were when they were first discovered.
Mills says there's also great opportunity in alternative energy sources. He highlighted developments in wind, hydro, geothermal, and solar power, and strongly advocated for gasification technology, which can convert coal or even garbage into energy.
So when someone tells me that they're going to build a new landfill, I suggest that they wear animal skins and carry a club, because that's where that technology is at. What does gasification do? Very briefly, it uses 8,000 degrees Celsius, and it vaporizes the garbage, turns the garbage to its molecular components, and then recombines it through a refinery process, turning them into a synthetic gas, which you then use in a turbine to produce electricity.
Mills says emissions from gasification are low, and toxins associated with incineration are destroyed by the high heat. He admits the facilities are expensive. Mills helped modify laws to make it easier for Canadians to produce energy with wind and solar and sell the excess back to utilities. He says solar panels on his home produce up to 5 times as much electricity as his family uses. The Conference of Arctic Parliamentarians wraps up today at the University of Alaska Fairbanks.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the new AT&T, your world delivered,
and by
First National Bank Alaska. Branches in 18 communities around the state and on the web at fnbalaska.com. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
Pink salmon returns remain poor in much of southeast Alaska, with a total catch of around 5 million fish so far. The commercial pink salmon fishery typically peaks around this time. About 200 seine boats have been fishing, and catches have improved, but many areas are closed to let more pinks escape upstream. So area management biologist William Bergman believes the total seine harvest will end up pretty short of preseason expectations.
We, of course, predicted a point estimate of about 19 million harvest. None of that harvest is pretty much coming from the southeastern Chatham Strait. Areas that quite often produce some sizable numbers haven't produced anything, and we don't anticipate they will. It looks like we won't meet escapement goals in that area. But looking on the bright side of things, if you sort of move south from Petersburg, or if you get on the outer coast off by Sitka, then it looks like runs are coming in moderate strength, and catches have picked up here.
At this point, Bergman thinks the total southeast catch could end up in the 10 to 14 million fish range. That compares to over 40 million fish last year, but only about 11 million in 2006, which is when this year's returning fish were spawned. On the positive side for fishermen, prices for pink salmon and other species remain higher than in recent years, and Bergman says there have been some good chum returns.
They've been fairly good. Hidden Falls was good. The hatchery Dipak has produced very successfully. There have been some of the hatcheries have not been as quite as successful as those two, but yeah, they certainly supported both the gillnet and the seine fisheries in July and late June.
Meanwhile, Bergman says coho returns seem to be strong so far, while this summer's sockeye catches were not. At this point, Bergman says the department is optimistic about the portions of southeast that remain open for seining. Fluoridated water has been a controversial subject in Juneau recently. Now residents and council members in the town of Craig on Prince of Wales Island are also taking a look at the issue. On the October municipal ballot, voters there will tell the council whether they agree or disagree with the decision to take fluoride out of the water. KRBD's Jay Marvel reports.
It was in the mid-1980s that Craig started putting fluoride in the water system. Mike McKimmons was the public works director at that time. McKimmons, now retired, says that the city started using fluoride after being approached by the Indian Health Service.
Indian Health Service had a program to put fluoride in all the villages. And they approached the city at that time wanting to install a fluoridation system here in Craig. The city council discussed it at, a couple of meetings, and ultimately they passed a resolution to support fluoridation of city water. IHS provided the equipment, the fluoridation equipment, and I think a one-year supply of the fluoride chemical.
Fluoride has been praised by dental health advocates and dismissed by those who feel it's medication and that medication is a personal choice. Over the last 60 years, municipal fluoridation has become entangled in much larger and unrelated social and political movements. During the Cold War, it was said to be a secret weapon of the Soviet Union. Fear of fluoride was also lampooned in movies like Dr. Strangelove. Mayor Dennis Watson says he knows there are many conspiracy theories about fluoride, but that's not why he came out against putting it in city water. He was approached by residents who questioned why it was being used. Also, he has health concerns. He's a cancer survivor and believes he should avoid fluoride. And he says fluoride can be added easier than it can be taken out.
There is a certain mindset that believes that you can filter it out. Well, I've heard from a lot of people you can't really do it. I've read a lot on filters that say that they will take it out, but I guess that's up to debate. But one thing that's for sure is that you cannot buy a filter large enough you know, a full size filter to run all of your water through, like taking a shower and stuff like that, is way beyond the reach of the normal person. So you can't filter it out. Showers, you actually absorb more of that kind of thing than you would just drinking water.
Watson says, although it was the decision of the city council to stop fluoridating the water, the process was lengthy and in the open.
And we had several discussions over 2 years at the council. You know, I was put on the agenda regularly, and eventually we took a vote and voted to take it out.
According to Watson, that's when the public became involved. Eventually, the council decided to put the question to the public as an advisory vote. Among the strongest critics of the decision to stop using fluoride was Di Thane.
You know, it really is a good, safe health measure that's going to ultimately help the kids in our community.
Thane, like Mayor Watson, agrees there's no shortage of material supporting or opposing putting fluoride in the water. But she is a dental hygienist who believes the statistic that fluoridated water cuts dental decay in children by 20 to 40%. Anecdotally, Thane says from what she's seen, kids in Craig who have been raised on fluoridated water have fewer dental problems than kids raised on non-fluoridated water.
You know, as far as the dental health of the kids in the community of Craig, you know, there's a difference between the mouths of children in fluoridated communities and the mouths of children in non-fluoridated communities. So, you know, I'm definitely a proponent of putting fluoride back in the water here in Craig.
Thane says she recognizes that there are other methods of giving children fluoride, fluoride drops, for instance. But she says, like so many other elements, such as salt, fluoride is safest when it is consumed in small, regular amounts. She says this is best done by having it injected into the water system in a controlled manner.
You know, we have such a great city program here, and we have water operators that do a fantastic job with regulating the amount of fluoride that goes in the water. And if you put it in the hands of the parents, not saying that they wouldn't do an excellent job, but it's easier for an overdose. It's easy for a child to get too much or a child to get a hold of the bottle, which, you know, really isn't a good thing.
The question being put to Craig voters is simple. Should Craig fluoridate its water? But this is only an advisory vote. If the voters say yes, the question then goes back to the city council. I'm Jay Marble.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Rosemarie Alexander in Juneau, Shane Iverson in Bethel, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Matt Lichtenstein in Petersburg, and Jay Marble in Craig. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. Our intern is Eli Meniker. John Prophet is our webmaster, and I'm Duncan Moon. From all of us here at the Alaska Public Radio Network, have a good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, and by
the State of Alaska Department of Fish and Game. Information about the state's predator management program is available on the web at wildlife.alaska.gov.
The U.S. Bankruptcy Court for the District of Alaska has set a deadline for filing claims for anyone who has been sexually abused or injured by priests or anyone working for the Fairbanks Diocese. The deadline is December 2, 2008. Claim forms are available online at dioceseoffairbanks.org or by calling 1-888-570-6269. This message is sponsored by the Catholic Bishop of Northern Alaska. APRN would like to thank Northern Air Cargo for sponsoring Alaska Morning News and Alaska News Nightly. To learn more about this sponsorship, call 907-550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.